Okay, it is October 19th, therefore this is our 70th class in our study of the chronological arrangement of the scriptures here in the Chronological Study Bible. Reading for this week was pages 984 through 999, which is the latter portion of Ezra in earlier chapters of the book of Nehemiah. And I think for most people, one of the more readily recognizable periods of time in Jewish history. Also, typically, I think, one of our favorite times in Jewish history. It is a very busy period of time. It has enormous successes. It has amazing engineering feats even that are taking place. But also, you know, just horrifying unfaithfulness in a wholesale manner. And so the ups and downs and the goods and the bads of people seeking to serve their God. There's nothing new under the sun. There's much in these events, you know, for us to see and to relate to and to learn from. And so a period of time that I've always loved, I think most of you do too, certainly in a variety of ways, a most encouraging one. So we've introduced this chart a couple of times, not going to spend a lot of time with it tonight, only to point out that this is the period of time that we've been studying the last few weeks, from the fall of Babylon in 539 B.C. to 3 years later, the first return under Zerubbabel in 536 B.C., the immediate beginning of the temple's reconstruction after it had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 586, but the people let the foundation lie fallow, not working with it, for 16 years, and so it would take until 516, exactly 70 years after it had been destroyed, that the temple is finished again, now under this great leader, Zerubbabel, and thanks to the efforts of the two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. Last week, we were introduced to this man, Ezra, who in 458 B.C., as we'll be reading, led a second return from the Babylonian captivity. And so it's a long time later, obviously. And Ezra is another amazing figure, like Zerubbabel, like Haggai, like Zechariah, accomplishes enormous feats because of his faith. And then, at the last part of the reading tonight, then we get into Nehemiah, who in 444, the book is saying 445, I use 444 for fortification. That's the first time I use that, and you probably heard me do it for me. But that's an easy date. Nehemiah was in 444 for fortification. In other words, he's building a wall around Jerusalem, whereas these others have been involved in reconstructing the temple. Nehemiah's particular chore is to build a defensible wall about the entire city. We'll have much more to say about that in just a minute. So we have these three key figures from 536 down to 444, which of course then is just real close to 100 years. So we're looking at a 100-year span. We're looking at these three, Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, as largely political leaders and getting, you know, physical things done involving the temple and the city, and then the two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. In due time, we'll be picking up Joel here, that prophet, in a little bit. Now, I'm actually going to leap ahead a little bit, but I thought I would just get the slides out of the way. I've only got a handful tonight anyway. So before we get into the text itself, what you're looking at is an artist illustration from the segment on Nehemiah's rebuilding the walls. And so you won't be able to read all of this, but this particular illustrator has taken what we know about that time frame and constructed an aerial view, giving probable locations and in some cases, you know, not so certain, but alternate locations for the various gates and other structures like this buttress that he was talking about in rebuilding those walls. So what you have, and it's to this day, as you'll see in a minute, what you have is an area of old Jerusalem, early Jerusalem, that has this Temple Mount, which is not quite square, but has very 90-degree corners on it, and then this area projecting down from it and running down the hill on the west side of the Kidron Valley,
that looks for all the world like Florida, doesn't it? And to this day, it still does. This is the Ophel, is the area immediately below the southern wall of the temple mount. And then the city of David is, beginning with David, the construction of a great palace, continued by Solomon, of course. That would become the location for the kings who were reigning in Jerusalem, and in which this very moment they're taking sand out of there. 16-hour time difference, I guess it is. So they are at this moment in the middle of the workday and uncovering what we think are the very foundations of David's palace itself. So the city, though, is being in Nehemiah's day, since the temple has now been rebuilt on a much smaller scale, it's these walls around about the city of David and the Temple Mount itself that we'll have in view when we get to Nehemiah here in a little bit. Then, just so you know, the length of that Floridian landscape is about 3/4 of a mile, 7/10 of a mile right there. So not a huge difference by any means, but it's probably a bigger building project than you've ever been involved in. And so if you think about building a wall now that is 3/4 of a mile long on one side and 3/4 of a mile long on the other side, and having then, you know, more to tie these two legs together, that's a whole lot of mileage in the end, you know, maybe 2 miles or more that is being constructed for defensive purposes. One thing more I think I'll just mention right here, though, is that this is called the Great Projecting Tower, and right next to it is what they're calling the Water Gate. So you will find in this last week's reading, you will have already read, some references to those two structures. Those structures also are readily identifiable to this day, because the Spring of Dihon was enclosed by those structures so that they would be able to defend the water supply and also have access to that water supply from within the city itself. So the spring, of course, is down quite deep here and into the side of the valley, and they built out and around it to ensure that they, under a siege circumstances, would always have their water supply. This is not quite the exact same viewpoint. You'd have to take this picture and turn it just a little bit like that to line up. And then the bottom part of Florida here has been cut off. But it was the best I could do to show you the walls as they exist today, and as they have essentially always occupied the same location. And so from a point actually way up here, there is a nice long straight wall that goes all the way down like that. You see it very prominently immediately on the west side of the Kidron Valley, which you're looking at right there. And then here's the Temple Mount itself, which in the previous picture was up more toward the top. And here you can see that first half of what is, you know, that Floridian peninsula there. But the wall is running along like this street does right here, and then along here, to this day, we have remnants of all of those walls. Now, one of the great debates here is whether or not Nehemiah was only building in this part that looks so much like Florida, or, and if you get in this aerial photo, you can see very clearly the walls right here. These walls all the way through, those walls may also have been involved. So, through the eons of time, we have Jewish history and then Christian history up to this day. Jerusalem has largely occupied first, you know, a smaller area, and then it expanded, but then what is called the Old City to this day has been readily identifiable for several millenniums, not just the time of Christ, but even prior to that, as we've been studying now 400 and 500 years prior to the time of Christ. All right, so those are all the slides I've got for this evening. Tonight we just want to carry into the text itself. Yeah, so let's do so by opening up to page 984. In this week's reading, it was particularly valuable, I thought, the uninspired commentary that you find in blocks that are labeled as transitions, or the one that's on the Levitical singers and various others that we had in this reading, made the reading particularly valuable.
shedding light, giving us historical references and that sort of thing to help us to see a little more deeply into the text itself. So from, though, that very first transition in the bottom right of 984, I just wanted to start kind of in the middle of that paragraph there and read in the first paragraph. Under the leadership, if you can find that right in the middle, under the leadership of a priestly scribe named Ezra, the group arrived in Jerusalem in the king's, that's Artaxerxes the first, in the king's seventh year, according to Ezra 7, verse 8, which would be 458 B.C. This is one of those dates in which we're really quite confident. So was it 457 or 459, you know, I mean, you can get, you know, and argue about what month it was and all that, but 458 is the immediate time frame. So Ezra, in 458 B.C., is going to be bringing some more Jews, a second wave of Jews, back from the Babylonian captivity. Some scholars locate this return in 428 B.C., the 37th year of Artaxerxes, or even in 398 B.C., the 7th year of Artaxerxes the second. See the book of Nehemiah at Nehemiah 1:1. So if you hold this page, we're coming back to this page in just a minute, but over on page 990, you'll notice that the first sentence in the first full paragraph on 990, right-hand column, right at the top there, the chronology of Ezra and Nehemiah is perplexing, but only in its minutia, okay? And so on 991, you see this huge chart that gives you three different possibilities and trying to work out some of the issues of how we know that Ezra and Nehemiah knew each other, worked in the same time frame, and yet there are other statements that seem to conflict with that. And if you want to tear into all of that or bore into all of that, you know, be my guest. I did not. I read all that information. To just simply camp on what they are calling the traditional or more likely view. So if you're still on page 990, in the right-hand column, and in the middle of the last full paragraph in that transition, so good luck finding this one, but it says, the traditional order of Ezra 7 through Nehemiah 13. Starting in Ezra 7 to the end of his book, and then all of Nehemiah, seems most likely. Ezra's reforms began in 458 B.C., but like all religious revivals, they did not affect everyone, nor did they last forever. When Nehemiah arrived 13 years later, there was still much to be done. One of the things that people cite most prominently as being a difficulty in the chronology with Ezra and Nehemiah is that in a period of only 13 years from readily recognizable events in both Ezra and Nehemiah's lives, in 13 years, the people are just wholesale apostate again. And so you would think that with all that they've been through, that they stay faithful for 13 years. I mean, is that such a long period of time? And so a lot of scholars, though, surprise me at how it seems they are awfully forgetful or negligent or something, I don't know what it is, that they act like 13 years from a period of fairly high involvement of faithfulness to a pretty low point of unfaithfulness is just an insurmountable period of time. 13 years, that just couldn't happen that fast. But what was one of the statements Paul made about Christians in Galatians? Marvel that you are so... Yeah, quickly. Okay. I don't want any 13 years at all involved in the Galatians going from first love to terribly, ridiculously, you know, bad behaviors, both behaviors as well as doctrinal errors. And so that's not unusual at all. The Ephesians, the same thing. Doesn't take very long at all. And we find them, you know, just a mess in Revelation. And so it doesn't take long at all. And it's scary, isn't it? Because it's equally true today. In a 13-year span, a congregation can go from a collection of largely very dedicated, very, very righteous, and very, very active saints to a rather motley crew of negligent pew warmers that aren't doing much work and are dwindling. And that doesn't take long at all. And here in our own American history, we've seen that take place time and time again. And apparently we're in another downturn at the moment. So what I'm saying here is that don't worry about the scholars, you know, tearing their hair out about, you know, a 30-year difference between, you know, when Ezra came back or 30 years later. Because ultimately it doesn't change a thing in the world. It's all within, you know, the tolerances. It doesn't threaten biblical accuracy at all. It's just minutiae, trying to get down to a month and a year and so on. All that would be great if you could, but when you can't, you know, it doesn't detract at all. What is impressive is on 985, in the left-hand column and at the start of the last full paragraph there, it says, the arduous journey from Babylon to Jerusalem took 4 months, from the first month to the fifth month of the year. Ezra 7:9 says so. So does chapter 8 and verse 31. So, Ezra gets up, takes a significant number of people, but not nearly as many as came back with Zerubbabel in the first return. And he now comes into town to stir people up again who are not doing all that well in their faith. Here's what it sounds like from Ezra chapter 7 and verse 1. After these things, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra the son of Sariah, son of Azariah, son of Hilkiah, son of Shalom, son of Zadok, son of Ahitub, son of Amariah, son of Azariah, son of Merioth, son of Zerahiah, son of Uzzi, son of Buki, son of Abishua, son of Phinehas, son of Eleazar. Do we know who he is? Genealogical records matter to those Jews. Ezra is a name that's used quite a bit. Now we know which one. This Ezra, in fact, it says in verse 6, came up from Babylon. He was a skilled scribe in the law of Moses, which Yahweh, God of Israel, had given. The king granted him all his request according to the hand of the Lord his God upon him. Some of the children of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the Nethinim, came up to Jerusalem in the seventh year of King Artaxerxes, 458 B.C. Ezra came to Jerusalem in the fifth month, which was in the seventh year of the king. The first day of the first month, he began his journey from Babylon. On the first day of the fifth month, he came to Jerusalem, according to, for the second time, the good hand of his God upon him. Where Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it, and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel. I think probably without exception, you were all here a week ago Sunday night. I preached a lesson that involved that 10th verse a great deal. But it is because this man is, according to verse 6, skilled scribe in the law of Moses. And he is also, according to verse 10, one who prepared his heart. He wasn't born with this heart. He didn't acquire this heart from his parents. This is not a heart that God gave him, you know, miraculously or directly. Ezra prepared his heart to do three things: to seek the law of the Lord, and to do it, and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel. I'm convinced, brethren, that the good hand of God was upon him, precisely because he was this kind of a man. He was a skilled scribe in the law of Moses because he set his heart, he prepared his heart, depending on your translation, to seek the law of the Lord, to do it, and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel. So I pointed out two Sundays ago, I think, even if you should prove to be the last living Christian in America, because no matter who you talk to, we are witnessing in the upcoming election the end of Western civilization, right? So even if you are the last living Christian in America, brethren, be the last one standing who had a heart that you had prepared to know the law, to do the law, and to teach the law. Be skilled. Do the best you can. And if you get carted off into Egyptian captivity, no, not the way the Jews did so long ago, pre-Moses' time, but the way Jeremiah, the faithful prophet, was, contrary to the very prophecy he gave to the people not to trust in Egypt. He finds himself kidnapped and dragged down there. You know, even if that happens to you, as it has to so many other faithful saints and prophets of the Old Testament, be faithful unto what? Revelation. Death. Okay. Ours is not to control the church's growth. Ours is not to be able to say this program or that program is faultless and perfect. It'll always work. The church will grow. It just bugs me how many books have been written on those topics. You don't control the environment you're working in. You might be Jeremiah himself and fail utterly to persuade anybody to join you in faithful service. That's not your job to force people to become faithful. It's your job to be faithful and encourage them as best you can. God, according to 1 Corinthians, I think it is, grants the what? God grants the increase. You don't control the increase. God does. You control your activity. Be living Ezra's. In Ezra's? Is that what it would be? Okay, we had a hand up back there.
I'd like for you to comment on what the text says about why Ezra was this learned scribe. It indicates that previously they were so consumed with duties at the temple and sacrifices that the law went without interest. And so being away from the temple, they then concentrated on scripture.
Yes, for the sake of the recording, Saber's referring to the transition there, that pointing out that there clearly is a gigantic transition that takes place in the attitude, and one I think should go so far as to say even sort of the structure of Judaism while it was in captivity for the 70 years that were prophesied, and then developing even in the later years after that, as so many of the Jews decided to stay in Babylon, returning over the course of 100 years in these three waves, and many never returned. But the point that Saber's making, as they made in the comments here in the text, is that a change takes place because they don't have their temple, and they don't have their sacrifices, and they don't have their priests, and they don't have the physicality of the law of Moses and its sacrificial system. But even though all of that has been first destroyed, and then they've been moved out of the country and turned into slaves, so that all of that is, you know, is 1,000 miles away and out of their control entirely, what could they still be? Do you remember the term that was used? They were the people of the book. Okay? That's an expression that is used to this day about the Jews, that they are the people of the book. Well, not so much. They rejected the Messiah of the book, so you can't accuse them much of being a people of the book today. But at that time, in captivity, they still had two things, to my stunned amazement. I marvel at it. But God, even as slaves in a foreign land under Nebuchadnezzar, God still preserved for them two things. The law of Moses, and therefore the genealogies, which they continued even in captivity. So Ezra rises up, and he's skillful in the what? Law of Moses, as Saber's pointing out, because he was a man over there. He was a priest. It says he's a priest, but he can't do anything about it. No temple. He's not in Jerusalem. But he can be a man of the book. Exactly. And by the way, I haven't read ahead yet to see if they ever mention it, but I think I mentioned it a few weeks ago anyway. Most people think that the synagogue was invented by Ezra and probably in the Babylonian captivity. They think this because of an inspired Jewish commentary and that sort of thing. It can't be proven, doesn't say so in the New Testament. In the New Testament, synagogues are just there. They're taken for granted. They don't exist in the Old Testament. Here they're full-blown in the New, and no explanation is ever given. But most think that, as Sabra was pointing out, when they became the people of the book, they were getting together in what now was the synagogue environment that they had invented so that they could do this studying and be successful then in knowing what they needed to do and then coming home so they could do it. Okay, so you know, then in the early going of chapter 7, Artaxerxes writes a letter there at verse 11, and that letter flows all the way down onto page 986, nearly to the end of that page where Ezra 8 begins. Now, part of the reason I don't have any charts tonight is that I was wanting to build one, but there was no way to do it really in shortened form. It wasn't going to fit on a chart very well, so I have some notes that I wanted to point out here. But high points in chapter 7, and as I'm reading from my notes, you can scan the text if you like to catch the drift in the actual biblical language. But I want you to note that there are 11 things that Ezra is charged to do, is given authority to do by the king of Persia. There are 11 things that this king, in his letter, gives Ezra the authority to do. It is titanic authority. It is astonishing that this old Gentile king would suggest these things. It is apparent to me that the good hand of God is upon Ezra, and Ezra is certainly involved in the creation of this list. But as you scan, starting in chapter 7 of Ezra, verse 13, he is commissioned to go to Jerusalem. He's given the freedom to leave his location there in the capital of Persia. Number 2, in verse 14, he is charged to inquire of Judah and Jerusalem. But you will notice very specifically, he is to inquire of Judah and Jerusalem about what? About the law. About the law of God, the law of Moses. And so that's curious that this king is very interested in sending this captive back to his original homeland, though he never lived there, of course. But he is to go back to this place, and he is to find out about the welfare of a religious system that this king's never had anything to do with. Verse 15, he is to carry silver and gold for the temple. He is given specific authority and the financial means to improve a now existing but small-scale temple. In verse 17, he is to offer sacrifices. And we will learn that the king is very interested in these sacrifices because he believes that if those sacrifices to Yahweh are not taking place in Jerusalem, it's going to reflect on him and his family. He fears Jehovah. And he wants sacrifices made in Jerusalem for him as an utterly non-Jew. In verse 19, he is to carry, Ezra is, articles of service for the house. So various utensils necessary for that sacrificial system are also being sent back with him. In verse 21, treasurers in Persia are to give Ezra whatever else he needs. So he's got a blank check from the king of Persia to all the treasurers in these various provinces to get anything else that he needs. In verse 23, the temple and the sacrifices are to be resurrected, and there it is, as I mentioned, to protect Artaxerxes and his sons. In verse 24, the temple and the attendants to that temple, the Nethinim on up, are to be tax-free. So none of them have to pay any taxes. They're serving the temple. Number 9, Ezra is given the authority to establish magistrates and judges. You think about that. With first Cyrus as the warrior conquering king, and then Darius immediately after him as the phenomenal administrator over the Medes and the Persians, set up their system with 127 satraps and all of that. Okay? Very sophisticated government system. What now is Ezra being told he can do?
go on home to your land and you appoint magistrates. You appoint judges. I'm going to let you have control over this government. That's a tremendous amount of respect and confidence in Ezra. Then in 10, number 10, verse 25, again, he is to teach whose laws? God's laws. He's not to teach about Marduk, the god of the Medes and Persians. He's to teach about Yahweh, the god of the Jews. And finally, in verse 26, he is to punish with what? There's quite a list there. Death, banishment, confiscation, or imprisonment, those who fail to obey the authority of Ezra. Reminiscent, in my mind, of the amazing authority, for instance, that Joseph would acquire in Egypt, or Daniel would acquire in Babylon. Ezra has now acquired in Neo-Persia. And in every case, who are these people when they start out? They are the lowliest of slaves in abject subservience to a conquering force that has killed legions of these people. And now down through the time to Ezra's day, you know, he's several generations deep and grown up as a slave. But if you could start as a slave and end up where? I just gave you three examples in the world today. Second to the king with unbelievable political powers. Just awesome. Why? The hand, the good hand of God was upon them. Why? Because he prepared his heart. Study the law, do the law, teach the law, and now he gets the command from Artaxerxes to do what? Well, since you studied the law and you're doing the law, go home and teach it. That's pretty cool. Okay? So, after the destruction of Western civilization, 4 years from now, what should we Christians then be doing? Rebuilding from the ground up. And brethren, this may not be the last time I'm already thinking of a sermon for you all. You know, I have several slots in my counseling schedule for those who have depression. I'm keeping them available for November 10th. Okay, I'm watching all this go down. But further, whatever goes down, in whose hands is it in? It's in God's hands. How good are God's hands? Pretty good. And every so often, what does he do? He burns it all to the ground like an overgrown forest. So what? So it can grow back in purity, so it can go back in devotion and faithfulness, so it can grow back into a flourishing, you know, faithful people. So, for those of you who fear the end of Western civilization, I stand ready to embrace it, brethren, because right now, this church is not growing, nor are most of the churches that I know. We're living in a time where our culture, you just can't interest people, you know, in a study of the gospel. You've all experienced it. Okay, so maybe it's time for what? A good forest burning. Bring it on! Because our job is not to keep an evil system fully functional. Our job is not to control the 9 justices of the Supreme Court. What is our job? Prepare your heart. Study the law. Do it. And what?
Teach it.
Whatever culture you're living in. Whatever the circumstances are. So, with these 11... Somebody had a hand up. I'm sorry, while I was reading. There, Bill, yes?
Is this Artaxerxes' first, I guess, the one that had Ezra for queen?
No. He would be, I believe, the son. Okay? Now, I had this all figured out last week, and I told you what it was. So, if you were here last week, you already know, and I forgot. But I think he's the son. He might be a grandson, I'm not sure, but I think it's the son. Not sure. I'd have to go back to last week's list.
Okay, so please note, brethren, we're just going to skip now, because I picked up on this, and I thought it was really important to recognize that when you're on 985, twice, once in chapter 7 of Ezra, verse 6, and then again down there at verse 9, the good hand of the Lord was upon him. Did you note that on page 986, the last sentence in chapter 7 is, I was encouraged as the hand of the Lord my God was upon me. In the second sentence in the right-hand column of 987, second line, by the good hand of our God upon us. You skip down to the fifth line from the bottom, the hand of our God is upon us. You turn the page on 988, and you're in Ezra chapter 8, and right after the title there where it says Return to Jerusalem, we departed from the river of Ahava on the 12th day of the first month to go to Jerusalem, and the hand of our God was upon us. Now, when you turn the page to 991, you're not even in Ezra anymore. Now you're in Nehemiah. Now you're 13, 14 years later. And it says, on page 991, at verse 4 in the left-hand column, first full paragraph, so it was when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before my God. So, has he got the right attitude? Yeah. Turn the page on 992, and in chapter 2, the last phrase, in verse 8, in the right-hand column, about the middle of the page, the good hand of my God was upon me. Look at the third line from the bottom in that column. The hand of my God which had been good upon me. So we get this expression over and over again in Ezra, and 13 years later, what do we got? Nehemiah is using that same expression. They were contemporaries. They knew each other. They worked together. They were facing the same culture. And it was pretty messed up for both of them, as a matter of fact, despite all the advantages and good start that they'd had. In short order, a decade or so, they'd fall into all kinds of apostasy. But Ezra and Nehemiah both had the good hand of God upon them, even when they were dealing with terribly unfaithful people, just complete failures. So, don't worry. Be happy. Okay? Don't worry, brethren. Just be happy. God can handle everything. He can handle Donald. He can handle Hillary. He can handle it. Don't worry. It's under his control. Now, let's note that over in chapter 9 on page 988, chapter 9 of Ezra, when these things were done, the leaders came to me saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands. With respect to the abominations of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. Where have you heard that list before? Moses. 1,100 years ago. Okay. Don't hang on. You've had 1,100 years of this lesson. I still don't get it. In verse 2, for they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, so that the holy seed is mixed with the peoples of those lands. Indeed, the hand of the leaders and rulers has been foremost in this trespass. So when I heard this thing, I tore my garment and my robe, plucked out some of the hair of my head and beard, and sat down astonished. That's no show. That's a proper response to a man whose heart is right when he sees the evil about him. Then everyone who trembled at the words of God of Israel assembled to me because of the transgression of those who have been carried away captive. And I sat astonished until the evening sacrifice. And I just want to point out, had to skip it, time's sake, but by the river Ahava, 3 days out of the capital city, Ezra, as he was beginning the four-month journey to bring all these people home, sat down and declared a what? A fast. What is he doing here? In verse 5, at the evening sacrifice I arose from my fasting. That fasting will be mentioned again later. Brethren, I would like to very, very passionately suggest that yes, indeed, we may have come to the days of fasting. And it is a practice largely unknown among the Lord's people, one that perhaps needs to be resurrected. When you're in difficult times, then that prayer and that fasting is met with the good hand of God. And the men who are these powerful and effective leaders in the worst of times, they are prayers and fasters. We maybe get where we are because we're not praying and we're not fasting. So we are driven to where we are to learn how to pray and fast again. It's powerful. It's effective. And so, in chapter 10, at the start, while Ezra was praying and while he was confessing, weeping, bowing down before the house of God, the very large assembly of men, women, and children gathered in from Israel, for the people wept bitterly. At the next to the last line on that column, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all these wives and those who have been born to them, according to the advice of my master and those who tremble at the command of our God. So, in verse 5, toward the end there in the next paragraph, in the middle of that paragraph, they swore an oath. And then Ezra rose up from before the house of God, went into the chamber of Jehohanan, the son of Eliashib. When he came there, he ate no bread, drank no water, for he mourned because of the guilt of those from the captivity. And then you come to the very bottom of the page, the descendants of the captivity did so. And Ezra the priest, with certain heads of the father's households, were set apart by the father's households, each of them by name. They sat down on the first day of the 10th month to examine the matter. By the first day of the first month, they finished questioning all the men who had taken pagan wives. And then, as you turn the page, 990, just above the transition at the bottom of the left-hand column, what is the last sentence in Ezra's book? All these had taken pagan wives, and some of them had wives by whom they'd had children. What did they do with those wives and those children in chapter 10? They put them away. You sinned. You must reap what you have sown. It will be a disaster for everybody. I can't help it. This is the only sure fix for the particular sin that you have committed. So they put the wives away and they put the children away. Does that mean that the wives and children were forced out of the camp to die in the wilderness? By no means. By no means does it mean that. You will find that you still have responsibilities to people. When the Gibeonites lied about coming from a far land and convinced the invading Jews and Joshua's day that they weren't, you know, indigenous to this land, and therefore avoided being killed, then Joshua finds out about it, but they'd already entered into a covenant with them. Ever there was a covenant that God cares about, it's the covenant of marriage. But when they made a covenant with just the Gibeonites, did they then kill them all? No. No, no, no. They made them, many suspect, the very first Nethinim. This term Nethinim that you read many times in the course of this week's reading is very difficult. We don't get a definition in Scripture. It means the devoted or given ones. They are obviously involved in the menial chores of the sacrificial system. And they are apparently not Jews. So this Nethinim that kept cropping up is at the very lowest level of temple service. Apparently, the hewers of wood and carriers of water that the Gibeonites were so long before. So, what's happening here is we are going to set these wives and children apart. But we're not going to starve them to death. They will no longer be treated like wives. They are not going to grow up among the Jews and influencing the Jewish children in these families. They are separated. But brethren, I do not believe that they are abandoned, you know, to die. Now, there'd be a lot of different circumstances. If you're marrying the daughters of foreign people and you're having kids by them, where were these foreigners living? Right there in the immediate city. But every one of the women that these Jews married were orphans, right? Well, these were not parents. So we go through all of this. What likely happens, they go back home to be with their parents. And everybody's unhappy because sin will always produce that. Please note, as you come now to page 991, and we start Nehemiah. 13 years later, what are we doing? The very same thing. Brethren, it's just endless. So don't be surprised and don't be discouraged. That's just the way it works. So now, words of Nehemiah in 991 there at verse 4. You'll find the first full paragraph in the left-hand column. It was, when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. And I was what? Fasting and praying before the God of heaven. There's a marvelous prayer there. We looked at Ezra's prayer a week ago Sunday. We've not time for the shorter, but nonetheless beautiful and powerful and effective, fervent and effective prayer of Nehemiah. So we come to chapter 2. In chapter 2, Nehemiah has a big concern for Judah. And that concern is that, you know, I need to rebuild this city. But I'm still over here, cupbearer to the king. I've heard that it doesn't have any walls. And gates are burned. Well, the good hand of God is upon him in verse 8 in the right-hand column. So in 9, I went to the governors in the region beyond the river, gave them the king's letters. Here we go with king's letters again. The king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me, and when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. So, 14 years later, what's Nehemiah doing? Coming back out of Medo-Persia, and his task is to build a defensive wall around the city. Immediately, he's met with resistance by whom? Great and poweringly powerful kings in nations that are fairly far away, too. The nations will always keep spies and emissaries watching to see if any nation's going to rise up and start causing trouble. And they have responsibilities under the umbrella of the Persian Empire to keep the peace. They're worried and they're unhappy. They might be really unhappy because they just may beat some of those parents whose daughters came back home. Okay. Thanks to Ezra and who? Nehemiah both. See, if you do this every 13 years, send the wives back home to the Gentiles, you going to make a very good name for yourself in the community? I guess not. Okay? And Nehemiah, of course, has these wonderful conversations. Preachers love this material, at least, with these guys who are arguing with them. So, over in 993, near the end of Nehemiah 2 there, top of the left-hand column, verse 19, when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us. And what is this thing? And will you rebel? So in 20, I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. Have you ever said anything like that to a Baptist? Time you learned how. They have no memorial or rite in Christianity. Why? Because they're Baptists. They chose to be Baptists instead of Christians. You ever said that to a Methodist, Episcopalian, Mormon, Jehovah's Witness, take a pick, Roman Catholic? Brethren, if they claim to love God, won't do a thing he says, invent a new religion, most of them very young, 100 or so years old, and some of these I've just named, all they are, they're just infants in religious history, utterly divorced from everything God ever taught, do they have any place in the kingdom of God? No! So who's going to tell them? Just us. And they will receive it most magnanimously, won't they? They'll receive it the same way Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem did. Okay? So, you know the end of the story because you already read it in Ezra. And you've read it many times in Nehemiah. They then begin, you know, in chapter 5, we've got to deal, you know, with another outcry of the people. He has to get past the problems from the Gentiles. He's also got to deal with his own people. But he is not backing down to anybody. He's going to get the job done because the good hand of God is upon him. So in chapter 5, you have this outcry over usury. They're charging interest. Well, he fixes that, sees to it that there's no more. They're having financial problems. So in verse 14 and the very bottom end of 995, what does he do? He himself, for 12 years, Nehemiah pays for everything out of his own pocket so that monies could be available for everybody else. And then we come to chapter 6. We have this great running battle I referenced a moment ago. No time to be reading it, but one, you know, attack after the other, Nehemiah fends them all off. And then succeeds in how many days in building the wall?
52. Now you remember it, you've heard the sermon 1,000 times. He built that wall in 52 days. A good 3, 4, maybe 5 miles of wall in 52 days. Why?
They couldn't handle God as a father.
No.
That's
it. Now Bill's right. Bill's absolutely right. But in this particular instance, we are told that the 52 days is because the people had a what? Had a mind to what? To work. Okay? Do you? See you Sunday. Thank you all.